Hello and welcome. My name is Jo Frost, and here with my co-host Peter Linus, this is Being Human. Episode 3, Peter. How are you doing?
I am good. I'm very happy that we've made it to episode 3. Out of how many? That's the question.
Oh, I don't think we'll ever want to answer that question particularly affirmatively. You were telling me earlier that your life is a little bit miserable at the moment, that you've cut out chocolate and sugar. Why have you done that?
Oh, I'm training for a mountain marathon. I mean, that Why? Should justify eating more sugar, I think. But I think going up mountains requires you to be less heavy. So I'm trying to get less heavy. It's easier, apparently. All running is better if you're lighter. So, yes.
Or just not running, which tends to be my idea.
Running is strangely my happy place too. I either listen or I just, you know, listen to something interesting or just zone out and just enjoy the world around me. Appreciate the beauties of creation. So I love running in its weird way.
None of what you just said makes any sense to me whatsoever, but that's okay.
I can see that. If you're not watching this on YouTube, you missed the facial expression from Joe that said, "What? You're married to a runner. You get these things. Like, that's why we do this together as well. We're completely different people."
That's true. That is. And I don't understand him. This makes no sense. What mountain are you running up? Why would you do that? Cable cars? For a reason?
It was technically not a mountain because Northern Ireland doesn't have any mountains, but it is over the side of Slieve Donard, our highest peak. But then 2 weeks after that, I'm doing the three peaks. So Ben Nevis, Scaffold Pike and Snowdonia in 24 hours. Fingers crossed. We'll keep you updated.
Yeah, I'll be sat on a sofa somewhere, not thinking of you. It'll be great. Anyway, on to the topic
of
the day.
You asked, yes. Mm-hmm.
I did. What are we chatting about today, Peter?
What is a woman? Or you'd like to rename it, what is a man? You'd like to argue. I want to chat about Barbie, my favourite movie. This is mainly my excuse to get it in. It did not win an Oscar. It wasn't movie of the year officially, but it was my movie of the year. And I already will have lost some listeners. I remember mentioning in the States Barbie and people just go, ooh. And in certain circles, to go and see it, even to critique it and analyse it, seems to be unacceptable. But there you go. Billion
but you
dollar.
Are Knuff. So you
no,
are
I am Knuff. I actually
it.
Have an I am Knuff hoodie. Somebody bought it for me, I'd just like to say. So I wore it recently. It was very entertaining. My kids clearly don't come near me, which can be a benefit. So that's when I wear it. I like it because it pokes fun at the culture and it wrestles with profound issues. It asks big questions, does it in a very witty way. It's like the court jester movie of the year for me. And it asks that question that no UK politician wants to answer. What is a woman?
Indeed. Indeed. It does fascinate me, that question, because it is never what is a man. The maleness is never questioned, but it is always the female. And I think I agree. I really enjoyed Barbie for a number of reasons, but I did find, spoiler alert, the ending really sad, because there's no reconciliation between the men and the women. In fact, really, the only solution is a sort of pat on the head to the men and go, well, if you try hard and work hard, you might get to where we are. It's almost the inverse of the patriarchy is just reestablished with Barbie on top. And it just, I found it really, really challenging.
I think it's clear patriarchy isn't the answer. So it has a good dig at that. But I think it also kind of says a version of feminism isn't the answer. And I, you know, you said spoiler alert, the bit at the end where she goes, she pulls up, and you're wondering, where is she about to go to? Is she about, this is clearly the ending. You're going to get your driver's license. You're going to get a job, or you're going to get a passport, something that says who you are. And she says, I'm here for an appointment with my gynecologist, which in this cultural moment, I was like, so to be a woman, the thing is not your broader identity, the passport or whatever, it is to go and see a gynecologist. That was a definite poke, it felt like, at our cultural moment, and said to be a woman is a biological reality. Yeah.
Absolutely. Her biology kicked in. And at that point, she could fully understand what it was to be a woman. And I think that's the conversation that we want to have today, because it is one of the most contested conversations around what does it mean to be human? it is around our male, female, sex and gender identities. How do we understand our bodies and our place in the world? And that's what we want to use the Being Human lens to explore today.
Yep. So you could name any number of stories. I mean, people that get cancelled. J.K. Rowling is obviously forefront of this conversation. We'll come back to her. Richard Dawkins, the world's leading atheist. I mean, he's nearly got cancelled for his views on trans because, again, he's a biologist at heart. And so he went to a biological view on that, and that got him into all sorts of trouble. Graham Linehan, who wrote Father Ted.
Nicola Sturgeon,
the former First Minister. I mean, this is the issue that kind of, in a sense, toppled her. Dylan Mulvaney.
May or may not know from TikTok and social media fame, was a Broadway musical actor, came out as a trans woman a few years ago and has caused quite a lot of controversy through sponsorships with Nike and Bud Light.
Bud Light, go woke and go broke. The American right reacted and took out Bud Light, basically. That's the one I know about. Nike, that's your forte.
Sports bras. I mean, no. But also, why don't you know more about sports bras, Peter?
Well, I do have two daughters, but yes, it's your specialist topic, though. We did like, so you've got a bloke, he's fundamentally born male, advertising female sports bras. It was madness.
Yeah. And it, so this is the world we're in.
There is a brilliant case now. I love Giggle versus Tickle in Australia. I mean, we're not even going to get into the detail, but it's just such a good name, Giggle versus Tickle. But it's essentially, again, somebody who's born male, identifies as trans, and wants into a woman's only app, and they won't let her in because they say it's for women only. And it is in the Australian courts right now. And the fundamental question at the core of it is, what is a woman? Which I suspect on that one, they're going to lose because of the way the law's framed, but it gets the conversation going.
Yeah. Now, it's fair to say you and I have been talking in different spaces on this issue for a while now. And one of the things that I found really helpful when we're having this conversation is some of the framing around why it gets so contested, especially around the issue of justice and fairness, because the question around rights, human rights, and what does it mean to be a just, fair, and inclusive society is where these two things seem to come at loggerheads with each other. Friend of mine was having a chat with me and she would say, why does it feel like when it comes to women's rights and trans rights, somebody needs to get thrown under the bus? And I suppose one of the best spaces to see that happening is around the sport issue, around who gets to compete in female sport.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes when I chat about this, I put up the image of Leah Thomas, who was born male, swam in the female category. And there's a picture of Leah, who's 6'1" or 6'2", and the three female athletes who competed in the Olympics at that time. They're all in the one shot. But I asked people to kind of put them in. If you were Team Leah, what would you say? Leah's being authentic. You do you. It's subjective. It's feelings. It's gender. But it's inclusive. It's justice for her. It's personal truth. And then I say, if you're team woman sports, what do you look at? And it's more scientific, it's evidence, it's objective, it's empirical truth, it's still justice. So you get similar terms, but justice here is fairness, as do gets included. So actually people are often viewing it through the same set of lenses or ideas, but then take different positions or views as a consequence. And most people fall somewhere in the middle and like, oh, I feel sorry for the person who's confused in their gender, but I feel sorry for the woman that's getting them excluded from a place. And then people are starting to wrestle through the tension because there is, as you say, a risk of a hierarchy of rights kind of forming. How do we look at this? I suppose that's right at the core of what we want to wrestle with today.
So lots of conflict, lots of dispute, lots of highly emotive conversations, because at the crux of this issue is the question, what does it mean to be human? And that's why these issues are so personal. That's why they're so fraught. That's why people get so caught up in them, is because these really do affect our lives. These are the lives of our kids, our neighbours, ourselves, people that we love and care about get caught up not in a culture war, but actually in the personal highs and lows of what it means to be human in this world. So we want to use the Being Human lens to help us navigate how we can approach this conversation and ask, what does it look like to live truly human lives when we're exploring this issue around what does it mean to be male, female, and how do we handle the trans debate? So, little whistle-stop reminder tour of what the Being Human lens is. We put at the focal point the issue that we're talking about. So that is, what does it mean to be embodied? What impact does our body and our sex have on our humanity? What is a woman? And then we are exploring around that. So the issues around significance, who matters, you matter, what does it mean to have dignity, worth, and identity in this space? We move over around to connection. How do we relate to each other? The fact that we are not islands, but that humanity is a we conversation. So this is a corporate issue. Presence, to be embodied in a time and in a place, is a massive part of where the trans conversation comes. What is my body and what impact does it have on my humanity and how I enter and occupy the world? And then ultimately, again, this participation, how we live in the world makes a difference. It matters. So how do we navigate these chaotic moments when it all seems to rest on personal choice and personal decision? So that's what we're going to do, Peter. And we're going to kick off with significance. Peter, what is the interaction with trans and this question of who matters and do we matter when it comes to our bodies?
It's a great question. So as you say, we're looking at kind of dignity, identity, value, worth in that. And as a consequence, often rights comes into play. So one of the big slogans out there is trans rights are human rights. And you see a lot on social media and you'll see it written on banners at protests. And my initial response is actually, no, that's not a helpful way to frame it. Hold on. Trans people have human rights. Absolutely. I think that's the right articulation. As disabled people have human rights, Christian people have human rights, male has human rights, females have human rights. Like, that's the way. Once you start to say there are trans rights, what does that even mean? And I think it's a really unhelpful way to frame it, as if each group has a set of rights that are particular to them and then they're asserted to be human rights. No, everybody has human rights, including trans people, because the first statement leads to the hierarchy idea. Well, I've got a set of rights, you've got a set of rights, somebody else has got a set of rights, and now we've got to work out how they all sit together. We're like, no, there's a set of universal rights that we all have, and that moves us away from hierarchy. Now, not without discussion and not without challenge, but I do think it fundamentally moves the conversation away. So, I mean, trans women, just to be clear again, is somebody who's born male, identifies as a woman, and they're claiming to be a woman. Well, in that moment, you've now redefined what a woman is. And this is where the whole thing really gets difficult and contentious.
Can I go back? Mm-hmm. Just, I want to push around that assertion that trans rights are human rights is an unhelpful framing, that there are universal rights that as a man, woman, trans-identifying person, disabled, whatever, we then assert those rights down. That's really interesting. I think, talk me through a little bit more about that, because I would normally talk about women's rights and the distinctiveness of me as a woman needing certain protections, certain amount of awareness, certain access, simply because of the characteristic that I carry as a female. So whether it's accessing healthcare or safe spaces or discriminatory rights in terms of employment, there are women's rights because there are distinctive rights applied to me as a woman. Tell me where that universalism kicks in how I'm used to dealing with that.
The universal nature of human rights, so the most, in terms of the core declarations, the most strongly asserted set of rights are the right to life, you know, right to family life, right to freedom of religion, that are universal in their declaration, the 1948 Universal Declaration, and it's seen as inherent to all human beings, and so everybody can claim those. So they're like the probably the top line set of rights that make sure they apply to everybody. I'm not saying, and I, you know, it's great pushback. I'm not saying there aren't rights then that follow within, sit under that for people because of who they are. I just think that way of asserting is, it starts a very problematic set, because on trans rights, it's not clear to me what is being asserted. On most rights to do with sex, they do apply to both sexes. I'm trying to think of a right that applies to a woman distinctively, because a lot of our equality legislation actually deals with 8 or 9 protected characteristics, and the sets of rights are set out based on, even in terms of sex-based rights, males and females have sets of rights falling under that. What is problematic is when you claim the group has a set of rights. That framing, I think, gets us into the hierarchy idea, and that's going to get difficult. The more universally they're held, the more broadly applicable and the more buy-in you're going to get. So I'm just trying to think of a good set of rights that are hierarchical like that, that we can push around with. That's where I suppose my question back is, what applies specifically? Because the framing is problematic.
Where I'm used to encountering women's rights would be around maternity and employment, that I have the right to return to work if I have a kid. I have the right to not be fired. There are certain aspects of my employment that, because I am a woman, those rights kick in. And not just a woman, because I have been a mother and had taken maternity leave, I have employment rights specific to me, distinctive to me, because of the characteristics that I bear in that circumstance. Again, gender pay gap would be the other space that a cleaner and a janitor have comparable roles and therefore should be paid comparatively, as opposed to the assumption in the 1950s, I'm slightly making this up, when the assumption was that the male was the breadwinner and therefore needed to earn more money because his salary went to a whole family, as opposed to a woman's salary that only went to her, supposedly, not true, but, and that was, therefore the discrimination was allowed, that men were allowed to earn more money. But that's been overridden, and they said that no, women, even if they don't do the same role, they get paid the same comparatively if the roles are like each other or at the same level. I would have said those are distinctive rights.
Yeah, I think the second set are much closer to what I'd be arguing, that the overall aim there is equality. So it's how to drive to treat equally. So the overarching human right is that everybody should be treated equally. And the method of getting there may be distinctive. The second set is essentially to make sure women are paid the same as men. So again, equal treatment. What's the overarching frame of rights is the equal treatment of all people. How do we get there may lead to a subset of either rights or ideas that we have to base around. But your question here goes on the trans right, goes to right to the core of it, because what are the trans right? What is it that's unique to a trans person? So they're often trying to claim either, particularly in our culture at the minute, it's essentially the biggest contested areas, those born male trying to claim women's rights in this moment and use that as a way to squeeze women out of the conversation, in my view, and claim those sets of rights to changing rooms, to spaces that are female only. So the biggest, most of the cases relate to that, or to employment that was held for women only shortlists, men are, those born male identifying as women are taking those spots. And so they are undermining the universal, the higher level right of equality of all people. So I'm not sure what the trans rights are in that conversation. The rights can't stand in isolation. And so that's the other part of the conversation I think is really healthy and helpful for us to have. To assert a right, what are my responsibilities in that conversation to make sure that everybody has those rights at the same time? And this has become a contested hierarchy that's unhelpful. And I think what we're trying to look through is a different way of framing some of this conversation to recognize the significance of people concerned. So you and I have both met parents. We've both spoken to people for whom this is a very real situation, for whom their gender dysphoria is something they are wrestling with. As far as I'm concerned, that's a very legitimate, genuine medical condition that people have. It's our response to that is also then a question for us as we recognize our own significance. The idea of being born in the wrong body is something I find much more challenging. The idea of experiencing gender dysphoria, absolutely. That's real.
So I think that's a really helpful movement, is to talk about where rights, where are responsibilities, and where does equality kick in? Because ultimately, that's what we're trying to do in the significant aspect of the Being Human lens, is to ask who matters and recognize the innate and arguably unquestionable dignity of every single human being. And that therefore, when we're engaging with anybody, whether they identify as trans, whether they're female, male, whatever, the dignity that person stood in front of you possesses is innate and undiminished. So if that's our starting point, it moves the conversation to be a lot easier in one respect to say, okay, so what does fairness look like in this space? How do I accommodate you into this space? How do you need to accommodate others into this space? Is your assertion of dignity to diminish the dignity of another person? Or is there a way for coexistence to exist? And I think that's the real space where I get quite upset ultimately about where some of these dialogues go, is how quickly it diminishes the dignity of somebody who is arguably on an opposing camp or shares a different perspective to me or to others.
Yeah, and one of the things what I'm talking about, I think you do something similar, is that putting the slide up and saying, put yourself in either team. I don't want to presume which one you're in, but think about Team Leah or Team Women's Sports and do both, because I want you to understand how other people might begin to think about this. And so for some people, I almost always refer to Leah Thomas as Leah Thomas. Leah was born, I think, Will. Therein reveals something, I'm not that sure. The name to me doesn't concede something, but we're trying to, again, for me, that's recognizing the significance of Leah, is to be able to use the name. Often in a conversation, I won't know somebody's original name and they can change their name by deed poll and that's their legal name. So I'm comfortable there. Pronouns, I wouldn't like to be forced, but I'm open to using them in terms of engagement. Otherwise, there's no conversation with somebody. And that's, I think, some of just real practical wrestle in the moment for some people. And trying to acknowledge, yeah, this is a difficult space to navigate. But if you don't recognize the name of the person right in front of you, there is no further conversation to be had. So
what, even in the last 10 minutes, having this wrestle through identifies some of the shifting sands and some of the complexity around the different stories, the different narratives, the different perspectives, the different experiences, all of which combines to confuse and disorientate us as we try and navigate this space. Our stories aren't coherent and they're very contextualized and personalized from the perspective of the individual. So that's our space. What's the better story? How do we attempt to integrate our perspective of what it means to be human into this space?
With difficulty, I'm sure, at times. One example that sprung to mind for me was just thinking about this, was J.K. Rowling was tweeting about a recent piece of legislation in Scotland. And in the back and forth, she said, this isn't based on like the Bible or God or something. I can't remember exactly how she phrased it, but basically said, where women were an afterthought. And it was just interesting, her kind of articulation, categorization of woman as an afterthought in the Bible. And that's, I don't think that's unfair in the sense that that's how the church has often portrayed it. I think we have to own our part in that. So my response, because I did respond on social media, because I was thinking, that's an important point that our culture has often accepted. And actually, the first human being is created, the Adam, in Genesis 1 and 2. And that, the confusion, the reason I'm putting that Hebrew term out, that's the end of my Hebrew, I can assure you, is that Adam is translated capital A, Adam, proper noun, if you like, Adam, on a couple of occasions. It's translated as male or mankind in some occasions, and it's translated as a more generic humankind on other occasions. And yet it's the same Hebrew term throughout, but our texts often choose different ways. So it's always the same. That's the first human being or the first earthling from the earth, from which, when that earthling is put to sleep, then we get the creation of the first gendered being, sexed being, the Isha, the woman. And some might even say the remnants and what is left behind becomes the Ish, the man. But the earthling leads to the two, the male and the female. And so there's no sense, because God creates human beings in his image, male and female, it creates no sense that the woman is an afterthought. But Christian tradition has sometimes done that. And I think that part of what JK said is fair, but not what the Bible says, not God's intention, not God's design. But bodies do matter. We're created male and female, and there is a distinction. It's equal but different, and it's set out there in Genesis. And that leads to some pretty interesting conversations from which many people would say actually feminism in its current modern form, heavily derived from Christian influences from where it had a much higher view of woman than the surrounding culture, but it has dropped the ball. So I want to hold those two things together and say, church hasn't always done a good job on this, but the fundamental text, God's design was incredibly freeing and equal. And there endeth my rant. So I nudge us forward into connection, your specialist subject, Joe. So if we begin to view what is a woman through the lens of connection, how do we think about that?
I think this is ultimately where the conflict sits. Because if it was just up to me, if the whole world was just my little bubble, there wouldn't be a problem here because I could just operate in my world and everything would be fine. But the fact that we have to get along with each other, the fact that humanity is not a single individual island, but that we are collective, means that we actually have to wrestle this through. So we do matter to each other, and how we treat each other and how we view each other matters. So yeah, we've already mentioned J.K. Rowling is probably the big voice that has shifted some of this conversation and allowed us to sort of hear a different perspective. I think up until maybe even 4 or 5 years ago, it felt like the kind of gender fluid, transgender ideology and movement was only going in one direction. And then the kind of the feminist gender critical voices started to emerge and say, hang on a second. And at that point, there has been a fracturing. There have been camps established and they've got quite loud. And I think J.K. Rowling's been a really, again, for me, an interesting case study, that what she said and how she has been portrayed has been quite stark. That ultimately she was there saying, you can do what you like, you can call yourself what you like, you can dress how you like, you can sleep with who you like, you can do what you like, but refuse to allow women to have same-sex spaces and say that a woman's body is real. That's a step too far. That was the moment where she became a bigot and a transphobe, and she got cancelled by a number of the Harry Potter cast and got disowned. And I think it was really interesting how her affirmation of being female became a lightning rod of conflict, fear, and injustice, ultimately, on how she was treated. And I found it fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and she, I mean, it was funny, particularly with Daniel Radcliffe in particular, sort of pushing back on her. So it's a young male actor who has come to fame off the back of her books, telling this older woman who suffered from sexual violence and has made that clear, who has funded a woman-only shelter in Scotland and put her own money where her mouth is, if you like. And he's telling her where she's wrong and what to think, and missing, arguably, what she would argue is the key point of some of her books. She always looked towards the marginalised and how they were brought in. She doesn't have any problem with those who are trans per se. It's the what that does to women. And so she's one of a number. I mean, Graham Linehan is the father, Ted, writer. He's a quirkier character for sure. But a number of the cast, again, Graham Norton, probably the leading one, but lots of others, and many comedians turned their back on him when he became more outspoken on this. And he became very outspoken and probably crossed some lines, but it was fascinating to watch a number of authors, John Boyle, the Boy in the Striped Pyjamas author, who again, a gay writer, coming back and saying, actually, Linehan was right and we shouldn't have cancelled him and this has got out of order. And so more recently, you've seen this kind of move back. And so the connection, the fracturing in families, like for whom this is very real or for whom there are just different opinions, it's a very kind of shibboleth litmus test issue. So tell us more about shibboleth. Now that I've just said that word.
So this is where we date ourselves quite quickly, because the concept of the shibboleth was introduced to me by The Joy That Is, The West Wing. And it's this biblical idea that if you pronounce shibboleth with a lisp, you're from the wrong part of town. And it is basically the idea that you're a spy coming into a culture or trying to infiltrate a community and corrupt it. And so if you can't pronounce shibboleth correctly, then it's a way of knowing whether or not you're part of my tribe or whether or not you're an outsider. And I think in a lot of these culture wars, we hear these shibboleths. Are you using the word, certain phrases, certain dog whistle politics style? Are you using words, phrases, and ideas in a way that I agree with? In other words, you're part of my tribe. Or are you using either different words or the words that I use, but derogatory, in which case you're part of a different tribe? So in the Christian space, for example, the quickest one for me is around the LGBT movement. Is your church welcoming or is your church inclusive? As soon as you put up the word inclusive, you're LGBT affirming. As soon as you put up the word welcoming, you are biblically orthodox on your sexual ethic. And those two words are shorthand to indicate which tribe you are a part of and whether or not you can venture into a space or whether or not you should steer clear.
It's a weird thing. I mean, we had a literal shibboleth in Northern Ireland. It was football teams or schools, but then the letter H or H determined which part of the community you were from. And it literally would have got you beaten up for saying it wrong. People ask questions, how do you spell certain things, to get the H or H out of you. But anyway, we've seen the fracturing. We see it even on LGBTQIA and LGB separating from others. How do we tell a better story into this moment of fracturing?
So I was listening to a different podcast and hearing the idea that where is the common ground? Where is the peace moments possible here? So conflict resolution, reconciliation would always try and say, instead of being opposing parties, can you name and understand the problems that you're facing? And I suppose for me, that movement towards reconciliation is instead of saying, this human being is my problem and pitting our humanity against each other, actually, where do we say we are all connected and we need to move to a place of peace and flourishing for all concerned? So can we start to identify some of the problems that each party is facing? And can we start to work together towards reconciliation and peace building instead of saying the party, the person, is my problem? Is there a way of us recognizing that the conflict can be shared and therefore resolution can be found? What is the movement to reconciliation when it comes to our connections?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful. It's very easy to fall into a culture war moment around this. And there have been some very helpful things recently, I would say, around this. And we'll come to the cast review and other things in a minute. But the risk is that Christians go, ah, wonderful, we've won this round, rather than how do we enter the conversation in a way that opens space and moves beyond the fracturing and the divides and moves us forward. But speaking of moving forward seamlessly, because I'm conscious of time, the third aspect of the lens then is presence. It matters that we are here now. And I think for me, that really drives the body part of the conversation, the physicality of this. and the now that is this moment is again unique, and this moment is different even than a year ago in this conversation. Is different certainly than 5-10 years ago. This wasn't on the radar at any level. We mentioned Dylan Mulvaney, and because the Bud ad was the one that maybe was probably the most covered, but that's almost irrelevant. That was a cultural values piece. That's the side. It is the two incidents you mentioned, the Nike one, and then the advertising of tampons. That was bizarre because you're like, but you don't have a body that requires those two things in a way. And how does that feel to a woman to have those two things advertised by somebody who's born male and presents in a very particular way around this issue?
And I think that that's the issue, that even just talking about kind of sportswear, one, even having this conversation can move us into a sexualized space because the female body is more often than not an objectified body. And therefore, even just talking about what kind of sportswear does the female body require has a certain element attached to it. But yes, here is a influencer on social media dancing in the garden wearing a Nike sports bra, but is utterly flat-chested. Now, maybe got some muscle there, but certainly not got any glands. And does not have any of the trauma that females may have when it comes to doing sport and the impact of gravity and movement, shall we say. So when Nike suggests that the engineering, the design, the functionality of a sports bra can be marketed by somebody who doesn't have any breasts is quite curious. And it said, at least to me and to a number of other people online, your body is irrelevant to the fashion statement that now a sports bra is. We are more interested in marketing this as a fashion item than we are in marketing this as sportswear. And that's a really interesting movement because, again, it says that the female body is ultimately a body to be looked at or appreciated or adorned, as opposed to being used, trained, equipped for sport. And Dylan Mulvaney became this kind of lightning rod of what does it mean to have a female body. But it is worth saying that when Dylan got caught up in this dialogue, the vilification and the dehumanizing vitriol that Dylan was subjected to was disgusting. It was awful. At no point was the dignity of Dylan protected, affirmed, valued. And I think that said a huge amount about where this dialogue goes and how important it is to recognize that any human being is an image bearer of God.
And it's one of the reasons we drive at the lens and in its completeness. So we could argue that's a significant issue, absolutely, but it's interconnected. This is the whole thing, is you've got to take it in the round. And it is massively important. I think one of the moments for me that really emphasized the presence piece was a Newsnight interview, actually, Jermaine Greer did, and Kirsty Wark was the interviewer, but it was about Bruce Jenner becoming Caitlyn Jenner. And so the first part of that was about the kind of cover image, and I think it was Vogue or Vanity Fair did the cover. It was very kind of sultry pose. So Jermaine Greer, the feminist, was saying, it's a very stereotyped view of what a woman is. I don't like it for that reason. But the second thing is Caitlyn Jenner won Woman of the Year. And she said, Jermaine Greer was saying that should not be possible, as in, Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce Jenner, is a 6'4" Olympic decathlete. That person has never walked to a bus stop in fear of the person walking behind them. They have never been in those kind of situations. And I think that for me was one of those moments, as my daughters were a bit younger then, as a father, just really beginning to think, yes, I have not generally walked through the streets and had a concern about my safety in that way. And, you know, the pregnant people language, the people who have periods language, this kind of we can just interchange and it's no different between, and the kind of safety piece around that and the experience of women in that moment was the piece that really, that piece of walking to the bus stop really hit me as Jermaine Greer talked about and said, you can't understand the experiences that we have and therefore the different practices that we put in place, what it is to carry something in your purse, what it is to tell somebody where you're going to be, what it is to have the phone and the finger ready to hit the button, .. And I just think, you know, this, there is a difference, and Louise Perry makes a difference point in her book. There's a physical difference between male and female and physical size, etc. Attacks happen in one direction, almost exclusively males upon females. We've got to acknowledge some of that. And to bring us right up to speed, I mean, the CAS review has just come out about the treatment of transgender children and how that care has been really bad in the UK.
So came out early April. CAS review is about what, concerning what, by who?
So healthcare for those who are experiencing confusion around their gender. It is a 3.5-year review that was commissioned by the UK government to look at the NHS provision for this, in particular for young people. And Dr. Hilary Cass was in charge of that review, and she's a consultant paediatrician, former head of the Royal College in that area. Lots of very interesting conclusions, a huge review. But was saying these kids had not been well looked after, but also the kids up to the age of 25, she was pointing out, don't have the brain maturity to make these kind of decisions, that the rush to put them onto puberty blockers and to medicalize the process was bad in simple terms. It locked in particular outcomes, and it did lead to irreversible treatment. And I suppose in summary, her point was, kids are not being well looked after in this process, and they're being socially transitioned too soon, and they're not being looked after, and it doesn't give their bodies time to develop. And the reality is that puberty and going through it is a tough time for many people in that space. They don't like all the changes that happens, but rather than immediately medicalizing that and blocking puberty or moving on to sex transitioning hormones, she's saying you need to go through counseling, you need to take a lot more time, because again, I would say she's affirming that bodies really do matter. We have to live into the bodies that we have been given. Now, she doesn't put it in exactly that language, but I think her conclusions are very similar to ones I would want to reach in that and say, yes, there is a better story around this, our bodies matter. And the solution is not to rush to a medicalized transition. And I think actually really positively on this, the UK is on the front end of a conversation that's dialed back a long way from saying, oh, we're just going to affirm what a young person tells us straight away and put them on a particular pathway. So we need to slow that all down. There are lots of what they call comorbidities. What that means is other conditions often at play. She was very clear. Family breakdown is at play. Mental health issues are at play, which is often autism. It's usually 7 times higher in those who would identify with gender dysphoria. And she talked about histories of abuse, and particularly sexual abuse, named all those things, that all of those are at play. You require a much longer pathway into this if you're going to be engaged in this. So I think she's broadened the whole conversation and brought a really solid evidence base to it. The overall thing on that is to slow everything down. We don't have the evidence base for some of the things we were doing. And so I think a real positive report in many ways, and a really helpful intervention from the government on this, and a shift in what's going on. That is not the same in Canada, not the same in Australia, not the same in a lot of other countries. It's worth saying, if you're listening in those spaces, Denmark, Sweden, France, the UK are probably the ones dialing back and saying, hold on.
So in the presence aspect of the Being Human lens, we are looking at the idea that to be human involves a body, it involves a place, and it involves a time, and that reality, our story of who we are, is built on those fundamental truths. The conversation about trans is often around an internalized understanding of who we are, that then tries to morph and mold the physicality and the environment of a person to fit that inner space. So, Peter, from your perspective, what's the better story to offer that kind of understanding of what is real and who am I and how does my body fit into that space?
Well, I think we need to acknowledge that we as Christians have sometimes said the spirit matters and the body doesn't. I'm an old BB boy and we had an old hymn, we have an anchor that keeps the soul steadfast and sure while the billows roll. And that's true, but it keeps way more than the soul. And there's a kind of theology and an articulation that, hey, our souls are going to heaven when we die and this world's going to be burned up and it doesn't really matter what we do and bodies are secondary and don't matter. And all of that's nonsense. And Paul says so in 1 Corinthians. And it was a Gnostic kind of heresy that said, inner me is real, the spirit is real, and the bodies don't. And the Corinthians were basically saying, hey, it doesn't matter what I eat, it's only my physical body. And then they said, hey, it doesn't matter who I have sex with, it's only my physical body. And Paul says, don't you know your members? And I think he's playing upon there, our members, like your bodies are part, your members of the broader church. And then he tells us that our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. So bodies do matter, but we as Christians have often narrated something that says they don't. And that's actually very similar to the kind of trans ideology. There's a real inner me who knows my sex and who I am, and I've been born in the wrong body. Our articulation is different, but the Christian thing that says, hey, the spirit matters and the body in this world and all that stuff is secondary. That's just bad theology. And we played into this conversation, and we need to replace it with good theology that says we are embodied beings. God gave us those bodies. Jesus came in embodied form. We are going to be resurrected bodily, 1 Corinthians 15. And bodies really do matter. And there's a physicality to what it is to be human now and in the new heavens and the new earth. And it's not an escapism, get me out of here as a wee spirit floating around on a cloud playing a harp. It is bodily resurrection to go and be in the new heavens and the new earth where God will make his dwelling place with humanity. And I'll stop there because otherwise I won't stop for another 10 minutes, Joe.
All right. We are coming into land. We are at the fourth and final aspect of the being.
Are we?
Land.
Are we really?
Looking. Come on. We can do this. Do you remember when we tried to keep this down to 25 minutes? Those days are gone.
Not happening today.
Participation, that what we do in this world matters. It makes a difference. I think the challenge we've got in this space is recognizing that we don't live in a good, perfect world. We live in a world full of flawed human beings. We live in a world of broken bodies. That actually a lot of the conversation that we will have been having, I can imagine so many people listening to this and going, yes, but, or what about, or you've forgotten this person. And I think that is the biggest challenge that we have, is that there are so many exceptions. There are so many individual stories. There is so much caveating that needs to be navigated as we attempt to participate in this conversation, that we are so aware of all the different bits and all the different problems and all the different stories that we are so nervous about misspeaking, forgetting somebody, ignoring somebody's truth, failing to recognize what it means to have a mental health issue, a physical health issue, to be intersex, to have something wrong with your biology or your space in the world, that all of those things means that we don't know what to say or how to be heard well. One of the analogies that we use in this space a lot of the time is of the Jenga tower. And we've pulled out so many blocks of what it means to be human, what it means to be male, female, what it means to have dignity, what it means for us to be just and communal. We pulled all of those out. We put them at the top. This Jenga tower of sexed bodies, embodied humanity, is so fragile and so unstable that every single one of us is scared that we're going to say something wrong, or we're going to forget to nuance it or caveat it correctly, that we would so much rather say nothing at all than be misheard or misunderstood in this space.
Yes. Totally. Because it's chaotic and it's contested and it's constantly changing. You know, we've talked about the chaos of, the CAST report acknowledges that actually the NHS was giving treatment without really any robust evidence base. In fact, remarkably thin and unstable foundations, I think is the phrase that was used in it. It is contested. We see that in the number of cases coming through. I mean, we've got the Maya Forstater case, which is an employment-related case that basically said you can have gender-critical beliefs. Those exist. If you think that to be a woman is a biological reality, that's a protected belief in law. Keira Bell took the Tavistock Clinic to court, and said that she had been rushed through treatment. This is a young person who grew up and had a double mastectomy and then regretted it and had wanted to detransition and said the clinic rushed me through. Kathleen Stock was a lecturer who was cancelled by her university you know, the census was even, the census people were the ONS who run the census were taken to court because they were trying to redefine or define for the purpose of a census what a woman was, and groups were going to court to say, you can't do that and you can't do that. We've got these cases all around the world going on. And it's changing. 2 or 3 years ago, some of the conversation we'd be having would have felt different, would have been heard different, would have looked different. And there has been a sort of, I'm not sure if rolling back is the right phrase, but certainly it's been changing. And I would say a centering again of the conversation. And it's certainly in the UK, it is probably a lot more balanced and engaged at every level. And it's different in law and culture than it is in different places. And in talking to people on the ground as well, there has been some movement at the top. And I want to use that phrase advisedly, but I think that's fair to say, like in academia and in policy, but in schools on the ground and in hospitals and in clinics and in GP surgeries on the ground, it will take a few months for some of the changes we're talking about to filter down through. And there'll be contesting at local levels that will mean the policy will roll out differently. And so your experience right now could feel very different than some of the conversations we're talking about. And so it's very difficult to participate when everything is so unstable by Turjengatar. This is the, not the arrow tip, but one of the most representative moments of the chaos that we've been chatting about so often.
So what do we do?
So strangely, I think this is one of the most interesting missional moments around. I've told the story before, but I was at a swim gala and a mum came over to me and said, I don't agree with all your tweets, almost certainly, open brackets, sexuality. But I do, I'm so glad you tweet about this. And she pointed down at the pool where my daughters and her daughters were swimming and said, it's not right that our daughters might have to swim against boys, and it's definitely not right they should be in the same changing room. And this was in light of some recent stuff going on in the States, the Leah Thomas and case, in fact, or that whole situation. And so opens a conversation where I'm saying, so why is that important to you? It's not somebody coming from a Christian faith background. I explain why it's important to me. And we begin a conversation essentially about what it means to be human, but why we think this bit of the conversation is important. And it does go to kind of worldviews, framing ideas, values, and it opens up the space for that conversation. I find people like J.K. Rowling and Graham Linehan and different people really interesting in the space that's being created to have some more of this conversation in a different way. And while it might seem strange, I do think the trans has opened up the more fundamental conversation about what it means to be human in a fresh way, in which essentially the evidence and the narrative is quite closely aligned to my beliefs as a Christian, which means it's a different way of bridge building. So it doesn't feel like I'm at odds. Now, of course, with some people I am in social media conversations and get more heated. But the average parent, the average person I meet has kind of got a reasonably high level of sympathy for the kind of ideas that I have and I have for them. And therefore, that opens up the bridge building moment that we're so interested in this project. And why do they think that thing's important? And therefore, how do we move the conversation onto something more substantive and more engaging? So I think it's fascinating to participate in this moment because the culture has basically put its hands up and said, well, we have no idea. We're really struggling with this one. And so we get to at least come alongside some people and have some really interesting conversations.
Yeah. Which I think for me is where we move into a kind of takeaway practices space. Because I do think we get to, using the word deliberately here, embody a different story into this space. So in the culture war space where you're either a trans ally or gender critical feminist, or you're sitting in the kind of confused, I don't know which camp I'm in middle, we do get to come along and say there is a different story to be lived here. There is a story that says every human being is made in the image of a good and true incarnate God, who made us flesh and blood, but breathed the Spirit of God into our lungs. And we can offer a story of Psalm 139 and say, you were fearfully and wonderfully made. And that there is a God who delights over you with singing. And that is the truth of your being, no matter what today's emotions, physical ailments, medical challenges, wherever you are at, there is still that truth over who you are and how you were made to be rejoiced in. And we get to live that story and share that story. We get to come alongside and say, is there a space of reconciliation where every human being can live a truly, fully human life? Because I believe that there is hope let's look what a hope-filled society and community could look like as we try and navigate these things through. I think those are incredibly powerful practices and storytelling moments to share with the people who are so confused around us. In our little notes, Peter, you've put that one of the practices here is study. Where are you directing people to dig deep and invest their study into this space?
Well, yeah, the reason is you can't just proof text this. It's not like thou shalt not, you know, whatever, be transferred. You know, it just doesn't, it's a theological question, and that's not to say you need to go and do a theological degree, but it's to say we have to do some more thinking. You can't just lift one verse and say, aha, that answers the whole trans conversation. It doesn't. So we have to think a bit more deeply about what it is to have bodies and be embodied. So we have a resource called Transform that gives some very brief introduction, and from there you can find some other reading. Preston Sprinkle has a great book on this, Embodied. He says, looking around to check that's the right title. And I'll do the other part of mine before you finish, because fasting, I think, is linked to that for me, because you hinted at the start that I'm off sugar and chocolate at the minute. And part of the reason, it's bodily discipline again. It's one of those things. So I think it can be really hard if our gender matches our biological sex and we have no disconnect with that. It's very hard to understand, as it is for me to understand somebody who's anorexic or somebody who's gender dysphoria or somebody who's experiencing depression. If you have no experience of that, it's very difficult to think what it would be like to not feel comfortable in the body you're in. We can have all sorts of questions what that means and why, but imagine that. It's so difficult to comprehend. Fasting is a tiny way of denying our bodily needs and, again, engaging with our body slightly differently. And just, I think, gets us thinking a little differently into the space. So it might seem like a kind of jump, but I think it's actually a really healthy practice we should be doing anyway, but might help us in this moment to think about how we understand our own bodies a little better. And then I'll let you finish with the last practice.
I think that's fascinating. I think for me, fasting is so much about control. I have control over my body. I have control over how I meet my desires, how I meet my own needs, how I fend for myself. I'm in control. Fasting reminds me that my body, my life, my being is a gift from God, and He provides for all my needs. It reorientates the order of my being in Christ more than my body is my manifestation and my projection of my own image. So I think, yeah, fasting is a fascinating practice to explore in this space. And finally, you're all going to be utterly shocked that one of my practices here is hospitality.
No way.
Who would have thought it?
Is there an episode coming when you don't say hospitality, Jo?
No. The ability to be guest and host and welcome another into your space, into your home, into their home, to share life with somebody is such a powerful practice. To listen to their story, to recognize and affirm their dignity, to offer hope in hopeless spaces, and to bring Christ into a space as we carry His Spirit and bring His kingdom. How on earth could hospitality not be the takeaway for this conversation? And with that, we're going to close it there. If you haven't read our book, Being Human in a New Lens for a Cultural Conversations, we're going to explore some of these stories that we've touched on today, and we explore some of the theology and what it means to look to Jesus for the true and better story for our cultural moment and our cultural conversations. Check it out at all good retailers. Find out more about what we're up to at beinghumanlens.com, on all our social media. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to this podcast on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, take care. God bless.